Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, details of the latest Green Room Exchange concert, a conversation with one of this year's inductees into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame, and a strategy to overcome the learning gaps that happened during the pandemic. First, as Kentucky approaches the end of the federal fiscal year in September of 2024, there is a potential for a child care crisis in Kentucky. Child care providers have already stopped receiving the sustainability payments that were keeping them up and running through the pandemic. Those payments have ended, and now child care programs are making tough decisions on whether to cut wages, boost tuition, or close. And bear in mind, this is a service that many working parents and the businesses and the organizations that employ them absolutely depend on. To prevent this vital system from rolling over that fiscal cliff in the fall, State Senator Danny Carroll is, in the current legislative session, sponsoring Senate Bill 203, also known as the Horizons Act. Joining us is one who did a lot of the research that went into shaping the legislation. Dr. Sarah Vanover has been working in early childhood education for over 24 years as a teacher, director, professor, and trainer. She has 9 books to her credit, all focused on early childhood education. She has served as the director of Kentucky's Division of Child Care and is currently policy and research director at Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first, what will happen within the Kentucky childcare ecosystem after that emergency federal funding that had been provided to keep doors open during the pandemic? What happens when that evaporates at the end of the fiscal year?
Well, first, you have to understand that childcare programs don't get to charge rates that pay their bills. They get to charge as much as families can pay. And so that means that economically, they've always been very fragile. A successful childcare program is one that can just pay all their bills at the end of the month and not be in the negative. And so during the pandemic, this really brought attention to the fact that these programs were already so fragile. They were struggling prior to the pandemic, but when enrollment numbers were decreased and additional staff had to be brought on to watch smaller groups of children, it just really exacerbated the problem that was already at hand. Now, the sustainability payments that were issued by the federal government, Kentucky divided that money up into 9 payments, spaced it out over about a 2-year period so that child care programs would have income coming in to support them. One of the biggest things that it did was increase wages for staff members, because we saw huge inflation in other fields. You can now start off, you know, at Target or Starbucks, somewhere in the $15 to $17 an hour range. Childcare providers in Kentucky, not just entry level, but overall childcare providers in Kentucky make an average of $12.39 an hour. And so giving those sustainability payments meant that they could be a little more competitive, not completely, but at least keep some staff from leaving the field. Now, the sustainability payments, as you said, have run out. There is one more part of the federal funding that lasts till September 30th. Most of it is focused towards our child care subsidy programs in Kentucky that help parents with affordable care, pay for the cost of background checks, just do some other small operational things. But with the sustainability payments running out, centers are already trying to figure out what they have to do in order to pay their bills. Some of them are reducing their staff wages back to what they were beforehand. And staff members are having to make the decision, can I afford to live on this or should I go to retail and hospitality industry and work there? Other centers are deciding to increase their tuition so that they can continue to pay those staff the wages that they have. But then, you know, if parents can't afford to pay, they leave. They leave the workforce. They leave the program. I spoke with a director yesterday who said that she just announced a 12% raise on tuition. Now, typically, most childcare programs will do a 2 to 3% cost of living increase every year, every other year, just to keep up with the cost of food, make sure that their staff have small annual or raises or small raises every 2 years. But 12% is a big jump. The same center is looking at another 12% increase this summer. So almost a 25% increase in 1 year. And families are coming to the director saying, I can't afford this. I won't be able to continue to go to my job. I won't be able to stay in school. And childcare providers in general, like the owners, the directors, the people in our field, we wanted to work with families. That's why we decided to go into this field. So when you hear these heartbreaking stories as a director, people are coming to you, you know, this is not your goal. You want to be able to support these families as best as possible. And then other centers just know that the families that they have can't afford a tuition increase. They can't keep paying their staff. And they're just thinking, is it worth it? Should I close?
So now we have Senate Bill 203, the Horizon Act, is working its way through the legislature to provide early childhood education programs the stability to stay open. How would it do that?
Well, the bill really is got a couple of prongs to it, I guess you could say. One aspect of it is sustaining programs that were created during the pandemic. Another aspect would be increasing access to childcare and starting new programs. And then a third portion of it looks at educating qualified early childhood educators in the field. So as far as increasing access, there are startup grants that are written into the bill that would allow for educators to start a family childcare home, be an entrepreneur, create their own business, or to start new centers, particularly in childcare desert areas. We have 120 counties in Kentucky, and 79 of those counties do not have enough childcare for the children that need it. And some of them are at an extreme shortage. Maybe they don't even have a childcare program in the county at all. So looking at those areas, we need to find ways to increase care. A lot of times a large center does not do well in rural areas because families are spaced further apart and not everybody has the ability to drive all to one center. So family childcare homes typically do better in those areas where you only need two or three families. A provider could watch up to six children not related to him or her in their home and still offer a high quality early childhood education. Those family childcare homes are also a lot more flexible when it comes to hours of operation. A lot of times they do most of the second and third shift and weekend care within the state. So we want to have a balance of increasing the family childcare homes and the centers. We're also looking at education. One of the things that the bill talks about is creating a new program at the community colleges. There's already an early childhood education program, associate's degree, at our Kentucky KCTCS community college system. But this would be a slight spin on that, and it would be an early childhood entrepreneurship degree. So it would have the educational components as far as child development and curriculum, but it would also have more of the business experience needed if you wanted to be the owner, director, or run your own family childcare home. So things like staff supervision, marketing, a little bit more of that business side of things so that our owners and directors could feel confident running their own businesses. And we are hopefully moving towards those businesses being more financially stable in the future. So that would be a component. And then the sustainability piece of this, there were a lot of new programs created during the pandemic with the American Rescue Plan. In fact, Kentucky really got a lot of national attention for the way that they implemented new programs and being the first state in the U.S. to do several programs. And so the sustainability portion of this funding would be to keep those changes in place, the increases that were put into place with the child care assistance program, supports for employees. We want those to continue, and they would need the funding to go along with them.
The bill would create a number of funds in support of early childhood education. There's a proposed Innovations in Early Childhood Education Delivery Fund. What's that?
Well, this is looking at unique ways to offer early childhood education throughout the state. I mean, we've always had centers and family childcare homes, and those are the two standard pieces of care. But we're looking for things that are a little more out of the box: employee-based childcare, 24-hour childcare for second and third shift employees. One of the things that inspired this was the Clark County Public School System recently created the Eagle's Nest, which was a childcare program specifically for their public school employees. And they subsidized the rate of care significantly. And it's a benefit to their teachers in the Clark County school system. And members of the legislature went and looked at the program and were thinking, why can't we do these types of things in more settings? So the innovations piece would kind of look at non-traditional examples of childcare and how we could get those throughout the state, how we could get them in desert areas, how we could look at more employee-based childcare, just different ways to support our working families throughout the state.
The legislation, the Horizon Act that we're talking about, it is comprehensive. It's a very broad bill, and that means that it will be expensive. What does that number look like? And given all of the other unrelated but important programs funded by tax dollars that the state has on its hands, what is the return on the investment?
The bill does have a large reach as far as creating new programs, supporting the programs that are in place. When Senator Carroll has spoke about the estimated cost, he has looked at about $150 million per year in the budget. And that is a large ask. In Kentucky, we have rarely given that many general dollars to child care programs. We get some money from the federal government for the Child Care and Development Block Grant, but we have usually only contributed a small state match to that in order to draw down all of our federal dollars. And this would be a huge increase. But at the same time, it has a big return on investment in local communities. When you hear the Kentucky Chamber talk about barriers to families, adults entering the workforce, child care is always at the top of that list. And without child care, as we saw during the pandemic, many people leave the workforce. And so that means that we have income tax reduction. We have businesses that either want to leave Kentucky or don't want to come to Kentucky because they don't think they would have the employee base that they need. There's a lot that goes on there that if we had stable childcare and a good infrastructure in place, that the entire Commonwealth could benefit. And that's where your return on investment really comes. One of the programs in the bill is an income exclusion for childcare providers. So if you work 20 hours a week in a childcare program, you would qualify for childcare subsidy, knowing that you could make more in other industries and we still need that workforce population. A lot of people are enticed to come to the field if they get that discount on childcare. They're there with their children in the building. I was a director when my children were infants and toddlers, so it has a great appeal. But the return on investment we see from that program is great because for every adult that we bring in, they can watch an average 8 to 9 children of working families. And so we see the return on investment by supporting those providers that we're opening up care to lots of other working families and helping to support them in our economic workforce. And those are the kinds of things that we have to think about when we think about the price tag attached. This is just as important to Kentucky as the infrastructure of, you know, good roads and solid transportation plans, because without this, these are the people that make it so everybody else can go to work. If we don't have childcare, early childhood educators taking care of our young children, then many other families will not have the opportunity to be independent part of the workforce.
Well, I'm sure you have your finger on the pulse of this legislation, and it has a way to go yet. What's your sense? What's the legislature likely to do here?
I know that many of the legislative members that I have met with are concerned about childcare and concerned about supports for the workforce. That part seems to be bipartisan. It seems to be across rural and urban areas. You know, everybody understands that childcare is important to have parents and caregivers in the workforce, and everybody's community is having workforce challenges right now. So that's a universal issue that we see throughout the state. We have a lot of legislative members that want to be fiscally responsible. I appreciate that. And so a large price tag can kind of be overwhelming, but we're also trying to redirect that conversation and explain the return on investment is a huge piece. We've seen other states that are also very fiscally responsible, like Kentucky, places like Idaho, Kansas, North Carolina, that their funds ran out, their federal funds ran out before us. They were several months ahead of us on giving out their sustainability payments. And as their funds have run out, they're already starting to see centers and programs close at a rapid rate. In Kansas, within 3 months after the sustainability payments ran out, 43 family child care homes closed. In North Carolina, they started losing programs in the end of October. They had 7 large centers in a desert area close at one time, 300 children in a desert area that lost care. And since then, I think they've had multiple centers closing, but I think the largest that they've had have been like 150 kids, but it's continuing at a rapid rate. Idaho, they've lost 86 centers in the past year. So if we look at states that are slightly ahead of us in the game, we're seeing the devastating effects that are going to be there. And so that's something that our legislature has to consider. Although we definitely want to be fiscally responsible, we also want to think what could happen if we don't put some kind of method in place to stop this.
So it's both a disruption of people's lives and also has quite a ripple effect in the economy.
Exactly. I mean, you have businesses that would lose a great deal of employees, reduce their productivity, and could therefore jeopardize their standing in the committee. But you also have families that want to be independent, that want to be able to care for themselves. And without the child care, they lose the jobs that they need. And then that puts them at risk of not having stable housing, of not having secure food sources, of not having reliable transportation. Those are all essentials that children need in place, a foundation that they need before they can learn. If a child is worried about whether or not they're going to eat or where they're going to sleep tonight, they're never going to experience higher levels of learning, which is what we want to see our young children do. And when I say learning, as a 3 and 4 year old, that does not mean sitting at a desk and doing a worksheet. That means exploring and problem solving and interacting with peers. But that type of learning, that play-based learning that we want to see for young children, isn't going to take place when there are foundations not being met. A family is much more likely to be able to meet those foundational needs when they can be independent and work and take care of them, their children themselves. So they need to be able to work, and they need childcare to do that.
That's Dr. Sarah Vanover, Policy and Research Director at Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Elementary and middle school students are recovering from pandemic learning losses, according to researchers at Stanford and Harvard, but there are huge differences across the country. Some school districts are testing better than in 2019. Many more are still worse off. And there's a growing emphasis on local, community-based solutions. The Lexington-based Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence recently secured a $47 million grant to launch one standout model, community schools, in 40 schools across Kentucky. Pritchard Committee President and CEO Bridget Blom is a co-host of our ongoing series on education, and her latest guest, Dr. Donnie Ray Hale, Regional Deputy Director at the Institute for Educational Leadership, is a proponent of the community schools concept.
Dr. Hale's body of work is rooted in addressing issues of race, equity, educational opportunity, college access, and human development. As a leading figure in the implementation of community schools across the nation, he brings a wealth of experience and insights that promise to shed light on how this innovative approach can reshape the educational landscape and empower communities. Dr. Donnie Hale, Jr., it's an honor to have you on Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
So, Donnie, share with us the difference that community schools can make and the promising approach grounded in the research that supports improved student outcomes.
Thank you. Great question. So often when we think about helping inner cities, urban communities, students experiencing poverty and homelessness, we oftentimes think about programs. We think about services. The difference about a full-service community school model, it really is about partnership. It's really about building on things that are taking place well in community. It's building on really the assets. It's building on partnerships and relationships that are already existing by really reshaping the conversation and thinking about how do we do this better together. It doesn't take more money. It really takes us thinking about how we do relationships that are really building on how we support students, family, and create the condition that we want. We all want better for our community. Sometimes we don't always know how to slow down to have the relationships in order to make a common view for what that better is.
So you're saying the things are there that we need to improve student outcomes and to improve our schools. We just need to better coordinate and align them and have an intentional process to do that. In your experience, what are some of the core elements that make the community schools model stand out from other educational frameworks?
I just want to highlight the things you said about being intentional and deliberate, because a community school is about being intentional and deliberate. It really is about emphasizing really relationships, a community vision, shared ownership and communication. But what makes it different in the core element is it's a coordinator. To coordinate, communicate, and collaborate allows you to really bring people in, and it also allows you to have consistent relationships. Oftentimes where we fall short in community is that we develop relationships and life happens. And so sometimes we don't have the time and energy to follow up. But when we think about removing the barriers and gaps, we need to have consistency in relationships. We need to have an understanding of what's going on in our community. But we also have to understand really what it's going to take for us to move the needle about things that matter. So if we're thinking about attendance, behavior, course performance, we need to be consistent that, hey, can we create a school where kids want to come to school? Well, what does that mean? That means that parents, students, teachers, and the principal need to work together. If we want kids to behave differently, we have to create an environment for them to function well. That means us communicating and working together, but it also means students having a voice in that planning of that school and that community.
So students, even in the at the table, along with educators and community members, designing their approach to improve school is a piece of the equation. So in the research, there are four pillars that need to be present for an effective community school. Can you talk about those four pillars and describe for us or share with us why each one is important by themselves and why they're so important together?
I will talk about the four pillars, but I want to highlight also the importance of a coordinator being a part of this process. So when we have a coordinator that works alongside of students, parents, teachers, and the community, we really are in a position to really think about the framework. So the framework really involves this idea of collaborative leadership. Collaborative leadership is really how do we work together and collaborate on things that matter. So it allows us to set goals on how we improve schools, how we provide services, and how we work together for a common good. When we think about expanded learning, we often think about after-school programs, tutoring, in-school programs, summer programs. But as we know, we can have all those programs, but if we don't have someone helping to enroll, helping to remove the barriers, helping parents understand what it's going to take to participate, then those programs go underutilized. Third, when we think about this idea of integrated student support, we know that the mental, physical health of students matters, but we also know mental health matters too. But we also want to create an environment where kids feel safe. But we also want to make sure that it's not only happening in the schools, that they can go home where families also have access to services. And so that third pillar is around this idea of integrated student support. So we're really supporting the well-being of that student. And then lastly, we know the importance of family and community engagement, but it can't be a one-off. It can't just be a PTA meeting. It has to be ongoing. It has to be something that takes place monthly, where parents are coming together, where they become part of the fabric of the school. Because oftentimes we drop kids off at schools and we expect teachers and the principal to do everything. But the reality is that oftentimes parents are the first teachers. But the other part, parents want dignity to be part of the process too. So how do we integrate really this idea of community schools where we're all working together for our common good? Because we know that healthy students become healthy adults that contribute to our, you know, to our society, but really help our communities to grow.
So the four pillars being you just mentioned, community and family engagement, extended learning time, collaborative leadership and coordination, and integrated student supports. Yes. So I want to unpack the integrated student supports piece just a little bit. And if you'll kind of share with us, what are some of the community resources that could be brought to bear to remove non-academic barriers to student success that would be in that integrated student support pillar?
In Orlando, Florida, when thinking about integrated student supports, they have clinics that are co-located in the school building. And so when we think about the co-location of a clinic in a building, that allows us to think about the mental health, physical health, and the well-being of that child. So a child can go receive services for dental, for a wellness checkup, but they can also get counseling services. At the same time, those integrated supports are also available to the parents. And so when you can integrate that in the context of the building, now students don't have to miss school. Now students feel like they're a part of something, but even more, their families being served. When I look at places like in Chicago, Chicago has mentors that are learning how to engage more deliberately by providing after-school programs, but they're really integrating to bring in social-emotional learning, tutoring, as well as career services. And so we're thinking about like how we integrate these approaches. And so we're being deliberate and intentional. In Miami, Florida, we have clinics that are in the building as well. We have also mobile units, but they're also connecting to universities that will provide mammograms, as well as diabetes checkups and check-ins. And so they're really beginning to think about like how we create these conditions where families are healthier, they are thriving, but they are getting what they need, but it's at a low cost or no cost to the family. So we're removing a barrier that oftentimes prevents people from going to receive services and at the same time developing trust. We know at the point of integrated student supports is that trust for healthcare, mental health, and the stigma that along with that are big. But when we can integrate it in the context of a community school, now families feel safe. And when people feel safe in community, then kids have what they need to grow.
And then teachers and schools are able to do the job that we've asked them to do, which is educate our young people at a high level and prepare them for success in life. So the community schools model really calls on the community to be at the table, wholly participatory in removing those non-academic barriers. So school can do what school is supposed to do.
Yeah, and if I may add, I think schools are challenged these days. Teachers are challenged. Systems are challenged. But community schools don't add more to people's plate. They really try to alleviate some of the burdens that we've all seen in the last few years. We want people to begin to work together, but it's not about adding more to a teacher's plate, but how do we support a teacher in their job? It's not adding more to a principal, which is thinking about how he or she manages that building, but hey, how can we partner with you? So we bring more resources. It's not adding more to a nonprofit that sometimes is taxable and may not have the resources, but thinking about how we can increase your participation with students and families. So it really is about how we come together for things that matter. Hmm.
Your work emphasizes issues of race, equity, educational opportunity. How does the community schools model address these concerns, particularly in underserved or marginalized communities?
My work for the last 25 years has been about race, equity, and educational opportunity. And it really brings to bear understanding people. Is that when we can understand the numbers and how certain things impact certain people, it also allows us to have conversations at the local level. Because here's what we believe around community schools. People most closest to the issues should be part of the solution. So when we're thinking about, as an example, in Miami Northwestern, in Miami, Florida, is that in 2010, only 50% of the kids graduated from high school. But when we begin to ask them, hey, what's important? And again, the reason why I'm bringing that school up, it's largely in a Black and brown community that has seen a lot of crime and disparities. But when you begin to ask the people, hey, what's important to you? And, you know, they want to go to college too. They want workforce development. They want opportunities. And so when you begin to understand what the needs of the people and understand the numbers of how it's impacting certain people, now we begin to come up with solutions. And so when we instituted the Education Effect, which is a university partnership, is that by 2014, the school goes from being 50% dropout to now 95% graduation rate. It's gone from 20% students going to college to now 65%. It's gone from $500,000 in scholarships to now over 30 million. But I say that, but when you begin to understand the people and begin to disaggregate the data, you begin to help people to understand, here are some solutions or some ideas that have impacted you in the past. It doesn't determine your outcome, but it helps you to determine what solutions that you want to take as you move forward.
So this is as true in the hills and hollers of Appalachia here in eastern Kentucky as it is in urban areas of our state and nationwide.
And that's exactly true, is that community schools are for everyone. And so that when we have a better understanding of what our community needs, it allows us to understand how to support people, but even more, it allows them to have identity to participate in our great country. We know that education is the great equalizer, but we know we have to improve the quality of education so that it's open to everyone. We also know how important it is to give people dignity to have a voice in their future. But it's also important to highlight that, too.
Donnie, you've dedicated your career to, quote unquote, creating possibilities with others. What advice would you give to educators, community leaders, and policymakers, especially at the local level, but also at the state level, looking to foster stronger, more effective partnerships for student success?
One thing that I know and I've come to learn is that people most closest to the issues have to be part of the solution. Is while I have a doctorate and I've done some travel and I've been in a lot of different places for work, I recognize that I have to listen more. And so when I think about policymakers, decision makers, and folks that are making decisions that impact people, we need to take some time to listen to understand their stories, because if we can help people to change their behavior based off of their own decisions, then maybe we can come up with some solutions that are long-term and that are cost-effective. And so the value of community schools, you're no longer throwing money at problems. You really help them to understand what type of things have impacted the community and how do people become their own solutions to things that matter.
Dr. Donnie Hale, thank you today for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
The proposal to build a $500 million federal prison on a former mountaintop removal site in Letcher County is still on the table, and the community remains divided over the addition of another among the 8 federal prisons in eastern Kentucky. Earlier this month, the Federal Bureau of Prisons published a draft environmental impact statement that is required before the project can move forward. A 45-day public comment period is now underway. And later this month, there will be an opportunity for Letcher Countyans to speak in person for or against the proposal. That will take place at Letcher County Central High School at 12:45 p.m. Thursday, March 28th. Coming up after the break, an inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame on this pension of ours.
Kentucky, which is such a beautiful, rich, wonderful place with such beautiful, rich people, and yet has this this need to shoot itself in the foot.
And Fenton Johnson offers a theory on why. Plus, the return to Lexington of Grammy-winning Argentine jazz pianist Leo Hanavesi. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Danville's Arts Center of the Bluegrass will host the Tiny Art Show, a pop-up exhibit and fundraiser featuring hundreds of pieces of tiny art from artists throughout the Bluegrass region. The exhibit is open 10:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday, March 23rd. For more information, visit artcenter.ky.org. Join the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning March 25th at Lexington's historic Kentucky Theater for the 2024 Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame induction. The event is free. Doors open at 6 p.m. and the ceremony begins at 7. For more information, visit carnegiecenterlex.org. For information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
The Carnegie Center for Learning and Literacy is about to induct more of the state's outstanding writers into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. The induction ceremony is happening at the Kentucky Theater on Main Street in downtown Lexington on Monday, March 25th at 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public. You don't have to register. This year's living inductees include George C. Wolfe, 3-time Tony Award-winning director of plays such as Angels in America and movies such as Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Lackawanna Blues, Marianne Taylor Hall, whose novel Come and Go, Molly Snow is a classic Kentucky story, and Tom Eblin's guest for this latest in our series on Kentucky writers.
Fenton Johnson is one of 6 great Kentucky writers who will be inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame on March 25th. Johnson is an award-winning novelist, essayist, memoirist, nonfiction writer, and creative writing teacher. He wrote the first novel about the impact of the AIDS crisis on rural America. Kentucky Humanities has chosen that novel, Scissors, Paper, Rock, as this year's Kentucky Read selection. Johnson grew up in Nelson County near New Haven, the youngest child in a big Catholic family that lived a mile from the famous Abbey of Gethsemane. He went off to Stanford University, where he received a Stegner Fellowship. He spent most of his teaching career at the University of Arizona and now lives in upstate New York. Johnson writes about big themes, love, family, faith, community, and human dignity. But those themes are often explored in the context of Nelson County and its people, or some fictional version of them. It gives his writing a distinct Kentucky flavor. Fenton Johnson is with us here today. Fenton, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, and thanks for that very kind introduction.
Oh, well, you're welcome. Well, first of all, congratulations on the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure. It's a little humbling, of course, to be in the presence of people who are so distinguished, and so many of whom have both been my personal role models, heroes, heroines, and both living and dead, and so influential in my work. I think it's hard to pick one among them, but of course, Wendell is the Dixie Limited on the railroad track, as Flannery O'Connor once said of William Faulkner, of all Kentucky writers. It's hard to single out any of them.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little about your background and how it's influenced your writing.
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, growing up, it was really a medieval world. It's taken me most of my life to really realize that. But growing up near a Trappist monastery, and it was a particular period in that monastery where the monks had, for various reasons, more access to the outside world than is currently the case. And so we had monks at the dinner table probably three or four nights of the week. My father was in charge of maintenance of the plumbing at what we would today call a small craft bourbon distillery. That presence of a communal and contemplative life, in contrast to the communal family life that I lived, those are probably the two greatest influences, I guess. You mentioned Scissors, Paper, Rock. As the Kentucky Humanities Council, I call it a book in common for the state. We discussed that book, and one of the reasons that I suggested it, I discussed it with Humanities Council, I suggested it is because it felt, even today, where family structures are looser than once was the case, it still strikes me as a family novel that everybody in Kentucky can relate to, knows a family like that if they are not themselves part of that family.
What is it about Kentucky's storytelling culture that you think produces such good writing, so many good writers?
You know, well into my lifetime, there were two things that were true, which was that the state was relatively underserved by electronic media. So the way that people encountered each other was through telling stories. And the other was that the state was relatively poor until well into my lifetime. And that meant there's one thing about, as a form of entertainment, stories are cheap. And there is a logical connection from the oral tradition to the tradition on the page. I would say I can think of a couple of exceptions, but most of the Kentucky writers that I know have in their writing features a very clear connection to the vernacular, the spoken word of the people among whom they lived. Wendell would say, and I would agree, that another aspect was that it was still a small town life. I don't know if this is still true, but at one point, Kentucky had the highest percentage of its population still living on farms or in towns of less than 10,000 people. And that lent itself both to a kind of community where stories are the way that you trade information and gossip. I think all of those are roots of various sources.
Well, all of your books, you tend to return to Nelson County in some way or another. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because my roots there are so deep. My family on both sides, my mother's side and my father's side, arrived in the 1780s. With some notable exceptions, most of the family members, most of the relatives, until the current generation, stayed within 10 or 15 miles of New Haven. My mother's family was from Hodgenville and LaRue County, although they originally were in Nelson County. And my father's family settled around New Haven and was always there. New Haven, which has these days maybe about 600 people. And so there was the depth of those roots. And when one has such a rich background to draw upon, there's not much reason to go elsewhere. On top of that, I would say that, and I think this is also true of most, not all, but most of the writers whose work I'm familiar with from Kentucky, we were intimately connected to the natural world. Much of the food that was on the table, we shot or fished out of the river, and we had a huge garden, and we lived on a farm until I was six. And what you did for entertainment was, you know, you went for hikes in the woods, and every person in my family, even today, has an affection for and some intimate familiarity with the natural world. The natural world provides us, not surprisingly, it's our world. We're just animals in the natural world, provides the writer with a ready source of metaphor of, if you want to put it that way, symbol, and a landscape to work with that is, it's a tremendous resource. I was very lucky. And then you have this history of the Civil War. My great-grandfather on my father's side was a Union soldier. I have come to learn that my uncle and grandfather, this is several generations removed, on my mother's side, one was an enslaver. I have cousins who are mixed-raced enslaved people who self-liberated, joined. I have a cousin who was a mixed-raced U.S. colored troops. That's a tremendously deep well, and it seems to keep providing me with material.
Yeah, so you're working on a book about that Civil War family history now.
Well, it's, what is this book about? You know, one thing it's about, and kind of not surprisingly, is this is 2024 is the 100th anniversary of the birth of James Baldwin, I think, among our greatest, if not our greatest, African-American writer. And so I've been reading a lot of Baldwin. It's also, incidentally, speaking of prophets, because Baldwin was definitely a prophet. It is, I believe, the 90th birthday of Wendell Berry, another of our Kentucky prophets. Anyway, Baldwin grew up in Harlem, but lived most of his life in Europe, writes so eloquently about home. As a gay man, I felt that I had to leave. I know that everybody didn't feel that way, but I felt that I had to leave the state and go to the big city, some big city. I went to, coincidentally, San Francisco. I didn't know anything about it. I just wanted to go west. I wanted to go to California because that's where you went in the early 1970s. This book, I think, wants to be a meditation on home. It also wants to be a meditation on the complex history of Kentucky, which is such a beautiful, rich, wonderful place with such beautiful, rich people, and yet has this this need to shoot itself in the foot over and over and over again. And I think that traces itself back to an unresolved, never really confronted agony of the Civil War, how much pain there was in the state and how deep was the collective agreement that we just weren't going to talk about that pain because it was too much pain, and the driving of the Black people out of the state, which really happened. And nobody wants to talk about that. And I think, speaking of, you know, deep wells, that's another deep well. And I've been led into it by this discovery that I have both. I always knew about the Union soldier, my great-grandfather, but I didn't know that some of my mother's ancestors were enslavers. And I did not know that I had mixed-race cousins who were themselves enslaved.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for being with us today, and I look forward to seeing you and many of our listeners at the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame ceremony. It'll be at 7 p.m. March 25th at the Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington. Thanks for being with us, Fenton.
Thank you so much for your time, and I'm looking forward to it, too.
For the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, this is Tom Eblin reporting for Eastern Standard.
Joining the 2024 Hall of Fame are three deceased Kentucky writers, National Book Award-winning novelist Mary Lee Settle, Paul Brett Johnson, a landscape painter who wrote and illustrated children's books, and Billy C. Clark,
whose autobiography was considered by Time magazine to be as authentically American as Huckleberry Finn. Green Room Exchange scouts the world for performing artists to bring to Lexington for multimedia and very enlightening live performances and cultural exchange. The latest is happening on Sunday, and Green Room's Lee Carroll is here to tell us about it. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Lee.
Well, thanks for the invite, Tom. We appreciate your support always.
And tell us about this upcoming concert. Who's going to be here?
Well, we're bringing in a jazz trio. It's Leo Hennevesi Jazz Trio. Kind of an interesting story. A couple of years back, we went to a show that Origins Jazz was putting on. It was Jeff Coffin Quartet. And we were sitting there watching the show, and the most amazing piano player was with him. So after the show, I went up to him and said, hi, I'm with Green Room Exchange. Would you consider coming back to do a solo concert here? And he says, yeah, I would do that. So about a year later, we reach out to him and we bring him to Lexington, and he comes and does two nights of solo piano. And it was absolutely exquisite. He's an incredible musician. He's from Argentina. Has a long history. He's played with everybody.
When Leo Hennevesi first performed in Lexington, as you mentioned, he was here as a solo pianist. Will this one be different?
Yeah. Leo's coming back with a trio this time. Some great musicians will be with him. He's coming with a drummer named Jeff Williams, who's played with Stan Getz, Lee Konitz, Dave Liebman's Lookout Farm, Joe Lovano, and Tom Harrell. He leads his own groups, and he's recorded 7 albums on the Whirlwind label. So he's really an incredible drummer. Bass player is Francesco Morcocci, born in D.C. but raised in Pisa, Italy. And he's played with a lot of really great musicians, including Dave Liebman. So I expect a really high energy, very interesting concert this time.
Well, that first concert last year, most of us, almost all of us, had no idea what we were in for. And I looked around the room at one point, and most everybody had their eyes closed, because that's how you consume Leo's music, isn't it? How would you describe it?
Leo is Argentinian. He grew up not in Buenos Aires, but in a smaller town south of Buenos Aires. And he really took us on a journey that night. We had slides showing various regions of Argentina. Each time a slide would come up, he would do a little introduction, and then he would play music based on the folk music of that era or just his impression. And Argentina is just a lovely country, and so he carried everybody away that night. It was really a beautiful experience. And we're going to see some of that, I think, in this concert. He says this concert will be original music and folkloric music. In other words, music derived from the traditions of Argentina.
Well, let's listen to a sampling here. This is a piece that was recorded when Leo was in town last year.
Yes.
That's Grammy-winning jazz pianist Leo Hennevesi. He's performing in Lexington this Sunday in a concert presented by Lexington's Green Room Exchange, and Green Room's Lee Carroll is with us. Lee, a little bit about this person. I think that story can be told best by, if you would, describe the schedule that Leo kept after his performance last time he was here, because that's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, well, the next day he hops in a plane. He headed back to New York City. He had a soccer game that day. He had 2 hours of sleep. He gets off the plane, he plays soccer, and their team wins. The next week he's on a plane, and he's going to Vienna to play Baroque music with a Baroque music group there. And the next stop for him was in Morocco to play with a group doing North African jazz. So he's all over the map. Leo is a Grammy Award-winning pianist, he got a Grammy for a solo he played on Wayne Shorter's last record. Leo was playing with him and Esperanza Spalding and Jack DeJohnette at the Detroit Jazz Festival, and the solo on that album got him a Grammy. So he's just a remarkable technician and a wonderful musician.
And a wonderful person, too. Very approachable, isn't he?
Well, he gave me a list here. If people want to know who Leo is, born in Argentina in 79, moved to the U.S. in 2001. He's been traveling the world playing music for 20 years. He has 11 albums as a leader and dozens as a sideman. He believes in music as a force of change. He practices the saxophone in hotel rooms. He doesn't support MP3 culture. He cooks pretty spicy food. Like his music, he won a Grammy. He wrote a piano book called Diagramas, and one of his compositions is featured in the Real Book 4-5. If you're a musician, you know what the Real Book is. So
that's great. That's great. So what time does the show begin, and how can tickets be had?
We're excited. This is our first show at Transylvania University. They have a couple of fine theaters there. It's the Mitchell Fine Arts Center, and we're in the Carrick Theater, which is their smaller venue. It is Sunday, March 17th at 6 p.m. at the Carrick Theater on the Transylvania campus. The interesting thing there is Greg Partain, who's head of the music department over there, is a fine classical pianist, and he has acquired a 9-foot hand-built Falcone piano, which he is going to let Leo play. So Leo will be playing a world-class instrument, and he's going to bring world-class musicians with him.
Oh, this is going to be fascinating.
It's going to be great, yeah.
And tell us about tickets.
Well, you have to purchase your tickets through Transylvania's ticketing system, www.transy.edu/calendar/tickets.
Got it. Lee Carroll, co-founder with Connie Milligan of Green Room Exchange. Thanks, Lee.
Tom, I would be remiss not to mention this one more thing. We have another concert coming up in April, April 4th. And the artist is Yakuba Sissoko. He's from Mali, and he is a Kora master. That will be at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center. We're pretty excited about that one, too.
All right. We'll circle back around and talk about that before it happens.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Thanks so much. And thanks for supporting the arts and the bluegrass.
Oh, you bet. Thank you, Lee. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.